Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. James Scott is a young man who writes about old battles. He's published 4 books about critical moments in wartime, including 3 about World War II. His latest book, called Rampage, is about the Battle of Manila, which pitted General Douglas MacArthur against an overmatched Japanese military force. It's similar to the battles the U.S. is fighting in the Middle East today. And there are lessons to be learned about who suffers when leaders make mistakes. Through his books, James Scott teaches us about ourselves. Here's our conversation. James Scott, as somebody, I have sort of an unusual name, and I have often wanted a simpler name at points in my life, but I was thinking about you as I was doing research on you, in this book. I looked up James Scott Writer, and I found a guy who does thrillers, and a guy who does, like, cybersecurity books, and a guy who does, like, political science. I wonder if you ever wish in this career that you had a like Bartholomew Scott or something was your name. Would that make your life easier?
Well, you need to tell me, you actually forgot the James Scott who does religious history as well.
Oh, there's another one. Okay.
In fact, just this past weekend, I was at a World War II conference and somebody asked me, he said, did you also write that book on 1 Corinthians? So exactly what you're talking about.
And you come from a family with a pretty deep military history, right?
I do. Well, it's deep in that my father was in the military. Neither my grandparents were, but my father was. And he was actually the subject of my first book about 10 years ago.
Right. Now, to describe a little bit, I know he was involved in an incident in Israel, right?
Yeah, Dad was on the spy ship, the USS Liberty, which was a ship that was operated by the Navy and the National Security Agency. And it was essentially a mobile listening platform that was dispatched to hotspots around the world. And he was on board when it was sent to the Middle East during the Six-Day War, and that was the time when Israel actually attacked the ship. It killed 34 Americans and injured about a little more than 170 others. So essentially 2 out of every 3 men on board were either killed or injured, and my father was the damage control officer. So it was his 24th birthday that day. You know, he was a Charlotte native, grew up right here in the Queen City, and his job literally was to prevent the ship from sinking after it had been hit by a torpedo, 821 rockets, and cannons, and even napalmed. And for that action, he received the Silver Star.
Now, was that something as you were growing up that he talked a lot about?
No, you know, he really didn't. I mean, we had Dad's sword hung over the wet bar in Mom and Dad's house.
And seems like a good place to have it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And let's put it around alcohol somewhere. Yeah,
and so, you know, if I asked him about it, he would tell me about it. But, you know, he didn't dwell on it. And, you know, Dad very much at that time in his life, you know, he was busy with his career. And, you know, he had 2 children and there were, you know, T-ball games and swim meets and summer vacations. And so it wasn't something that was really there. Now, when I got older and was writing as a newspaper journalist and was covering the military, I started asking Dad, hey, you know, Dad, you were involved in this weird incident in the 60s. You know, tell me more about it. And from that actually grew into these conversations with Dad, and I eventually did oral histories with him. And then he invited me to the 40th reunion. And so at that point, I met a bunch of shipmates. And one thing led to another, and I ended up writing a book about it.
Do you think you would not have written a book about it had you not been maybe covering the military or something?
That's a great question.
Career before?
I potentially wouldn't have. I mean, I was interested. I was, as you know, I was a post and courier reporter and was covering the military and the big Air Force base there. So I was traveling. You know, I went to Iraq and Afghanistan with them. And so it was at the forefront of my mind on a daily basis what was going on. And so, and then, you know, we have a very close family and we get together quite often. And so, you know, it was because of that I was like, you know, Dad, tell me about your time. And so it just sort of grew out of that. So you're right. But had I been covering something totally different, had I been a sports writer or something else, it might not have come out of that.
And did you know when you first started asking your dad about it that this was sort of a historically significant event? Or was it just something that happened to your dad?
No, it was really something that happened to Dad. And I'll tell you, you know, one of his shipmates had done a book back in like the 1970s on it. And so like I had a copy of that book. And in fact, I read it when I was starting to talk to Dad about it. And, you know, beyond that, I mean, and it was like the book that Dad had on the shelf right there in the den, you know. And
right. So
But beyond that, I didn't really have an appreciation for what a big deal it was, and nor did I have an appreciation for what a traumatic experience it was for those men on board. I mean, you know, you really, it was such an incredibly violent attack. So, and I had no idea about any of it.
Yeah, and so obviously from there, mm-hmm. you've gone on to write 3 more books about World War II in various aspects.
Yes,
were that just a kind of a natural progression for you, or how did you move to that?
Well, interestingly enough, my first job out of college was an English teacher in Japan.
Really?
And so, yeah, I did the JET program, which is the Japanese government brings about 2,500 Americans over every year to go and teach directly in public schools. And so I went to a junior high school out in rural Japan, a little town of about 19,000 people. The town actually doesn't even exist anymore. It's been gobbled up by a neighboring municipality. And so I was sort of dropped in the hinterlands of Japan for a year. And while I was doing that, I also volunteered at night to teach in a community class in our little town. And so I had a lot of older folks in my class who, you know, had grown up during World War II. And so they said, you know, one of them I remember telling me, well, you know, I remember the B-29 raids in Kyoto. And well, that's actually the subject of a book I'm working on now, in fact, actually, the B-29 wow. raids. And so, and then, and while I was there, you know, I went down and I visited Hiroshima. And then my parents, coincidentally, were going to be in Hawaii for a couple of weeks. And so I flew to Hawaii to meet them. And of course, my dad, being a retired Navy sailor, we went to Pearl Harbor. And so I just so happened to go to Hiroshima and Pearl Harbor literally within just a few weeks of each other. And, you know, these are really the bookends for America's experience in World War II. And here I was 22 years old and was just hooked. I mean, I found both of these experiences to be so fascinating. And so I think all that kind of then led me back. I wanted to write for a living. As you know, the only thing you can do and earn a paycheck and write was at that time go work for a newspaper.
Sure.
And so I did that and ended up covering the military in Charleston, and then kind of one thing sort of grew out of it. But once I got finished with the Liberty book and my editor said, you know, hey, what's next? What are you interested in? I immediately gravitated back to World War II.
And specifically Japan, right? Because all 3 of these books that you've done since the Liberty book, they have in common some part of the
Pacific theater. Yeah, that's my area of interest. You know, I've spent a year in Japan. I've got, I've still got a lot of friends over there, and I go back there. I'm going back over there this spring, actually. And so, you know, it's an area that I understand. I've traveled a good bit. You know, I've been to the Philippines. I've been, you know, to Singapore and Guam. And so I've been to a lot of the places that are sort of central in the Pacific narrative of World War II. So it's really where my interests are.
Before we get to Rampage specifically, mm-hmm. I want to just get an idea of, in general. So World War II is obviously something that's been written about a lot.
Correct.
And there's been movies and volumes of not just sort of commercial nonfiction books, but obviously academic books and papers and all that stuff. How do you figure out, like, which piece of that very large pie mm-hmm. that you're going to try to attack in your book?
Yeah, and that's a great question. You know, there is a vast volume of literature on World War II, but it's surprisingly European heavy. There's a lot less done when you move over into the Pacific theater. I mean, there have been probably about 1,000 books done on D-Day, over 200 done on the Battle of the Bulge. And the book that I'm just published now on the Battle of Manila is the first major American book to tackle this entire battle.
Wow.
And so there's really, you know, and that said, I mean, there even in the Pacific theater, there are parts of the war that are pretty heavily covered. I mean, there have been a number of books on Midway and Guadalcanal and places like that, sort of these big pivotal battles that people know. But really, when you start looking at that larger landscape of World War II, you realize there are lots of these stories out there that have fallen through the cracks and have not been covered. And so as a reporter and a journalist, you're always looking for what's that story that hasn't been told? What can I add? What can I bring that's new to this? And so, and often it may be in this case, for instance, it's a story that very few people know and hasn't been done. Or in my previous book on the Doolittle Raid, it was access to, you know, documents in Japan and overseas archives that people had not yet checked. So sometimes even if the story's been told, by digging deeper into the historical records, you can bring fresh perspective, fresh new, you know, voices, new information on it. And that's what you're always after.
Did you find things in here that you feel like you felt sort of like Indiana Jones, like you were the first person to have seen this or the first person to sort of uncover?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I'll tell you, you know, the Battle of Manila is really, it's a civilian story. About 100 civilians died for every 1 American soldier. Just gives you the perspective. So this is really, it is a battle born on the backs of the men, women, and children of Manila. And so as I was researching that, and I was going through the vast amounts of war crimes testimonies, I copied all these records. I digitized them And so when I was having, when I'd finally gotten the first draft of the manuscript done, I sent it over to some folks in the Philippines I know who are a survivors organization that they have there. The head of that organization was reading the manuscript, and he emailed me one day, and he said, I want to know, on page 350, you quote this woman. Where did you get that quote? He says, the reason I'm asking is because that's my aunt.
Wow.
And I said, I said, well, you know, I've got her war crimes deposition. I said, you know, I said, Jose, why don't you give me the list of all your family members? And so I ended up having about half a dozen depositions from his family members, including his mother's deposition.
That he didn't know about?
He didn't even know about. He lives in Manila. He's president of the Organization of Survivors. And here I was able to bring new material to him. And he said, man, this confirms the stories that were passed down through my family from that time. So I feel like, you know, not only in this story are we able to bring new information to an American audience, we're even able to bring new information to those participants in the Philippines. And that's what makes this such an important story, I think.
And one of the things you do in the book, obviously, is you sort of shift perspectives mm-hmm. from chapter to chapter. There'll be a chapter basically kind of from the American's point of view, mm-hmm. a chapter from the Japanese point of view, and then a chapter from the Filipinos and others mm-hmm. who are on the ground in Manila. And there's this, you know, these incredible stories from basically what I would call a concentration camp mm-hmm. there. Is it St. Tomas?
Santo Tomas, yes.
Santo Tomas. Mm-hmm. Could you kind of explain what that is?
Yeah, Santo Tomas was, the Philippines was an American colony. And so it was filled with, you know, leading up to the time of World War II, it was filled with loads of Americans, not only soldiers, but lots of business executives from companies like General Electric, Studebaker, B.F. Goodrich. And so their overseas agents were there with their families. And so when the war breaks out, the Japanese immediately invade the Philippines. And so all these Americans are stranded there. And the Japanese round them all up and put them in Santo Tomas, which was a huge school, it was a big university. It was a day school, though. It wasn't designed to house people. And they ended up with about 3,700 mostly Americans. And they spent the entire war locked on this 50-acre campus. And they had to essentially fend for themselves. You know, they had to build a functioning city out of a university campus. And what was great about it, and for their perspectives, is that they had people from all walks of life. You had everyone from executives to plumbers and electricians to teachers. So they were able to build their own hospital system there. They were able to manufacture things like soap. They were able to build the toilets they need, plant the food that they needed. They had a whole school system to educate the children. There were about 500 children there, and they had a whole curriculum for the children. So they built this thriving city. Now, later in the war, however, as times got more and more dire, particularly from 1944 into 1945, the food ran out. And at that point, the conditions inside the camp really began to devolve, and it became a life and death struggle. So by the time Battle of Manila takes place, an average of 3 to 4 people were starving to death a day inside this camp.
Yeah, so that's what I wanted to kind of get you. So that's where they're at, mm-hmm. at the point that the Battle of Manila begins.
Yes.
So could you sort of set up the moments that led to the Battle of Manila mm-hmm. and sort of why it happened?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's really important to remember that, you know, MacArthur at the very beginning of the war is essentially driven out. You know, he declares Manila an open city because Manila was, at that point, it was the heart of America's colony over there. I mean, it was this beautiful city. It had been designed by Daniel Burnham, who was one of the nation's America's top municipal planners and architects. You know, he helped with Union Station in D.C. and the redo of the National Mall. And he'd gone over to the Philippines in the early 1900s and helped lay out this great city that had really thrived all the way up until World War II and become this real showcase of American, sort of the image of America, if you will, in the Philippines. And so MacArthur wanted to protect that. And he had lived there for a number of years himself. He'd married his wife there. His son was born there. His mother had died there. He had this real personal connection to Manila. I mean, it was for him, you know, as a son of a career military officer, Manila was the closest thing he had to a hometown. And so he wanted to protect that. So when the war breaks out, he declares Manila an open city, which means he's taking it off of the battlefield. And he evacuates all of his forces to Bataan and the fortified island of Corregidor. And, of course, there the Japanese advance. And eventually MacArthur has to escape on a motor torpedo boat, and the rest of his troops are captured. That's the Bataan Death March.
Bataan Death March, yes.
And so MacArthur, when he gets to Australia, he says, I shall return. And those three words become this obsession for him that drive him as he claws his way back north from Australia back to the Philippines.
I think you mentioned in the book that somebody mentions that this is sort of his white whale, as Moby Dick.
It's exactly
to come back and save this place that I think other people felt, and maybe he felt too, that he had abandoned, right?
Absolutely. And you're correct. That is, I mean, for him, it's very much like Ahab in Moby Dick. This becomes those three words, this promise becomes this obsession. And for him, you know, it's about getting back to Manila. It's about getting back to this one place in his life that he had been happy. I mean, he left so fast that he had this lovely home atop the Manila Hotel, but they had to evacuate it and reduce their entire life into just two suitcases. He left behind, you know, his son's toys, his wife's jewelry, his father's war medals from the Civil War. And so he's desperate to get back and to avenge that earlier defeat, if you will. So you fast forward 3 years, and at the beginning of 1945, American forces do in fact return. And so that then they land on the beaches of the island of Luzon, which is where Manila is, in January 1945, and they begin that race to the city. And that then sets up the Battle of Manila.
And there they meet General Yamashita. Am
yep.
I saying that right?
General Yamashita, yes.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
From Japan. And mm-hmm. One thing that struck me about this book is that he and MacArthur seem to have some parallels in their lives.
Very much so. You know, MacArthur had, you know, he sort of spent much of the war sort of toiling and the war's backwater, if you will. I mean, Europe was sort of where the America's spotlight was. He'd watched his subordinates, like Eisenhower, rise up and sort of eclipse him. And so he had a little bit of a chip on his shoulder about that. And Yamashita had been an amazing general in the Japanese army earlier in the war. He defeated the British and seized Singapore with a third of the forces that the British had. And he'd earned the nickname the Tiger of Malaya. But his rivalry with War Minister Hideki Tojo had led Tojo essentially to send him off to Russia and to guard the wall against a potential Russian invasion.
He was a little too good.
He was a little too good, yeah. And so he spent much of the war on the sidelines until Tojo's ouster in 1944. And then at that point, Yamashita is resurrected. And he's sent to the Philippines to stop MacArthur and to prevent MacArthur from making it through the Philippines. And of course, because he's the last bulkhead before an invasion of the Japanese home islands.
And another thing I thought was sort of parallel between them was that they were, I'm not sure if innovative is the right word, but, you know, at sort of the beginning of the battle, MacArthur sort of surprises Yamashita by showing up a lot earlier than mm-hmm. he expected. But the one thing that really stood out to me as you were kind of detailing the histories of both men was this, how Yamashita took Singapore.
It's fascinating.
It's really, yeah, so could you tell that story a little
bit? Yeah, absolutely. Of course, Singapore was the crown jewel of the British overseas empire. And, you know, they'd built this amazing naval base there. And they had positioned all their guns, largely because it was a sea base, thinking that the attack would come from the sea. And so what Yamashita actually did is he invaded north and came down the Malaysian Peninsula there. And he did it using a very antiquated form of transportation. Bicycles.
Yeah.
And it's truly
the only bicycle invasion I've ever heard of.
I know. So they literally sent about, I think it was close to, you know, 30,000 bicycles over there because the British had built a great road system and he was going to take advantage of that. And bicycles don't require gasoline or fuel. And they sent along, and if you blow out a tire, you could literally ride on your rims, which they did. They also sent bike mechanics, but it allowed them to cover, you know, 30 miles or so a day as they sort of advanced straight down the peninsula. And when you would blow up bridges, for instance, you could just literally lift the bicycle up and swim if you had to and cross over. So it really, a lot of the things that would delay a modern mechanized army, it didn't affect them. And so the British were stunned by this. And so Yamashita really, before the British know what happens, he's covered all that distance and is at the front door of Singapore, really the back door of Singapore, I should say.
So there's these two powerful and really in some ways generals who are getting ready to face off mm-hmm. in Manila. But one of the things that really hit me hard as I read this book was the realization that to both of them, they thought it was sort of a futile endeavor. Mm-hmm. The U.S. had an overwhelming advantage, and Yamashita basically tried to tell his superiors, we're not going to win this, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, I mean, he was there. I mean, at this point, the war was really over. I mean, the Americans had far more firepower, far more, you know, economic horsepower. I mean, it was just really a matter of time. And Yamashita's superiors really kept holding out for this one great battle that was going to turn the tide of the war. And of course, that's never going to happen at that point. I mean, that's just and so it's sort of a lost realization on their part. But Yamashita is sort of dutifully following his orders And he goes and he agrees to keep it up. And so, you know, he fights for Leyte and then he eventually sets up for the battle for Luzon and Manila. But it's a lost cause. And in fact, he even says at one point, he goes, it's my turn to die, I guess.
Yeah.
And so he knows it's a lost cause.
Yeah, yeah. That just seems to be, you know, it's sort of especially heartbreaking to know all the people who died, all the people who suffered in this battle, to know that it was probably unnecessary.
It was, and there was no military strategic value of Manila, too. And yeah, that's so important to remember. Manila's sole value is in its waterfront and its deep water anchorage there, that it could be a position for the U.S. Navy to park its ships and to have, you know, warehouses and things like that. But there's no tactical advantage of having banks and schools and neighborhoods. And so it really not only – and you can, of course, destroy the waterfront pretty easily with, you know, with bombs and things like that and leave the rest of the city. And so really when you look at the loss, it's just – it's that much more painful because it just there wasn't a value to it.
Right. And so you have, you know, MacArthur coming in, you have Nemachida sort of reluctantly engaging in this battle. And then I guess there's sort of a third major character there, that's this Japanese admiral whose name I'm sure I'm not going to get right.
Sanji Iwabuchi.
Yeah. Correct. So explain what his role in all this was.
Correct. He is far down the hierarchy from Yamashita. And so he's a much lower figure. And he too had sort of an interesting backstory in that he was a Navy rear admiral. And he had been present down during the Battle of Guadalcanal. And he'd actually had his ship shot out from under him by the Americans in a sea battle one night. And instead of going down with his ship, which was expected in the Japanese culture at that time, he had survived and was rescued. And it had been a big disgrace. So he'd spent much of the rest of the war parked behind a desk and back in Japan until the deaths of so many more capable seafaring officers led to his career resurrection. And he was sent to Manila, where his job was to oversee the Manila Naval Defense Force, which was a small contingency of about 17,000 soldiers and Marines, whose job it was to wreck the port and the warehouse facilities and things like that. But he really saw in Manila an opportunity to redeem his earlier failures, essentially by creating an urban bloodletting, a quagmire, modeled much after like Stalingrad in the European theater. And so despite the fact that Yamashita had wanted his forces to pull out of Manila and fight a protracted guerrilla war in the mountains and jungles, Iwabuchi decided, no, I'm going to keep my small force and we're going to stay in the city. We're going to fortify Manila and we're going to fight to the last man and try to do everything we can to hold up the Americans. And so you had this real divergence between Yamashita and Iwabuchi there.
And that in Manila is where the worst of the things
absolutely
happened.
Absolutely.
I guess I want to stop here just a second to say that for people who read this book or think about reading it, there's some very graphic stuff in here about things that soldiers suffered through, more so things that civilians suffered through, not just being killed, but there are rapes and there are, you know, other really bad things that happen. And some of that is told in pretty great detail, especially to the point when Yamashita goes on trial and some of the survivors and people like that start telling their stories. Mm-hmm. I wonder how you evaluated, as you were, I'm sure, reading stuff, probably stuff that was even worse than the book, what to leave in and what to leave out.
You know, that was a real challenge. And I think for people to, it's important, you know, for listeners to know that, you know, the Battle of Manila is really a battle that is defined by the atrocities committed by the Japanese against the civilian population. It's really, it's like the Rape of Nanking, which happened in 1937, 1938 in China. And this is sort of the bookend. The Rape of Nanking occurs early in the war, and Manila occurs late in the war. And about 100,000 civilians died during the Battle of Manila. Now, some of them died during American artillery, but many of them died at the hands of the Japanese. American war crimes investigators later determined that there were 27 major atrocities that took place inside Manila during that 29-day battle. And so, you know, the challenge when you're writing a book like this is you want to be as historically complete and accurate as possible. You know, I mean, it's a history book. But at the same time, you don't want to gross out readers and prompt them to put the book down. And so there's that fine line, that balance. And in fact, when my editor read the first draft of the book, he called me up and he said, so we've just got it. There's too much violence. We're going to have to take some out. And so so we talked about how best to go about doing that. We ultimately took out about three chapters. And then what we did is we chose to spotlight some of the larger, more prominent atrocities that are still very common and people talk about in the Philippines today, but also ones that are different and unique. Because unfortunately, when you're killing on this wide of a scale, tends to be pretty formulaic in some cases. I mean, the Japanese frequently just surrounded buildings and set them on fire and shot people as they came out. You don't need to tell a reader that six times.
Right.
Once is enough. And so instead, we kind of looked at, you know, the attack on the Red Cross headquarters or the attack on St. Paul's College and or De La Salle and things like that that were more unique in how these killings took place. And so,
and it seems like there's also, I don't know if obligation is the right word, but, you know, one of the things I've thought about reading this book is how distant most of us are these days from what war is like. Mm-hmm. The U.S. obviously has been very lucky in many respects in that most of the wars we fought have not been fought on our soil.
Yes.
And so I don't think the majority of us have a real visceral sense of what it's like to be in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. And so it does feel to me that there's also a duty or something, as you're telling the story, to say, this is really what it's like. It's not just a video game, right?
Yes.
And so I wondered about that as well.
One thing I'll add to that too, Tommy, that, you know, I think the difference in sort of how is the material that we had here, because the Philippines was a U.S. colony, and as soon as the reports of the atrocities were coming in within a week of the battle, and so MacArthur on February 17th, literally just a little 10 days or so into the battle, orders all atrocities investigated. And so when the battle actually ends, American officers realize we're looking less at a battlefield and more at a crime scene. And so from that moment on, they bring in just teams of war crimes investigators who fan out across the city, interviewing people in field hospitals. And I mean, these field hospitals were really anything with a roof, like a primary school or even the Manila Jockey Club. So they were getting these depositions. They were photographing these wounds of these victims and getting that immediate testimony. And this isn't an oral history done 70 years later. This is someone telling you what happened to them 2 weeks later,
right,
while they're still, you know, stitches and their wounds and things like that. So those documents literally run into the tens of thousands of pages. Unlike the Rape of Nanking, where the documentation is far less, here's a case where you have it just more than you can even handle. And I think that gives the immediacy and that intimacy of these types of scenes in the book that you talk about, because it's in their own words. In fact, when I was writing the book, I put a note in the end that said, unlike previous books, I chose to quote very liberally from the participants and the survivors, because I think it's so much more powerful for the reader to hear it from the actual victim than it is to hear it via middleman like the author, and to get those voices out there.
There's one moment that it made me think about the type of person I would be in that moment, and that's where this guard, who's known for his cruelty at Santo Tomas, is basically the Americans come in, and I guess they try to capture him, and he makes a move like he's going to attack, and they shoot him. And then basically the people he's abused over all these years kind of come in and take their shots at him, right?
Yeah, they do, actually. They come in, and he's lying there on the ground, and they put out their cigarettes on him. They cut the buttons off of his uniform as souvenirs. And even children participate in this. And as one of the participants said, you know, this is what war does to people.
Right.
And it really is. It's a powerful moment.
When we come back, James Scott talks about the war crimes trial that even U.S. military attorneys thought was unfair. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
I want to mention something special we're doing here at WFAE. For those of you who are podcast creators, or maybe you want to be podcast creators, between now and January 27th, we're taking entries for the Queen City PodQuest. Just submit your idea to us. We'll narrow down the best through a round of public voting, then a live event where the finalists will pitch their ideas to a panel of judges. Among the prizes are cash, gear, and a podcasting deal here at WFAE. So now's your chance. You can learn more at wfae.org/QueenCityPodQuest. We'd love to hear from you. And if you prefer to just enjoy Southbound as a listener, we'd also love to hear from you. The best feedback is a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Those let Apple know you're listening and make them more inclined to show us a little love. You can also email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org or tweet at me @TommyTomlinson. Thanks for your support. Now, back to our conversation with James Scott. Spoiler alert, the Americans win. And we end up in the last section of your book is sort of devoted to, most of it anyway, the trial of Yamashita, where, as we talked about a little bit, these people get up over and over and tell the stories of what happened to them and what happened to the ones they loved and all this sort of thing. One of the things I didn't know, one of the many things I didn't know about this, but one of the things that sort of struck me most directly was that Yamashita was defended by U.S. military, people as a military trial. Could you sort of explain kind of how that came about?
Yeah, I'll say, you know, it's interesting. This is the first war crimes trial in all of Asia, and it happens literally right after World War II ends. And they pick – it's in the old U.S. High Commissioner's residence right in downtown Manila. It's now actually the U.S. Embassy there. And the ballroom where this trial took place is still there. You can actually visit it at the embassy. And so the trial is held there. And Yamashita is put on trial for he's accused of failing to control his troops because he wasn't in the city during the battle. But as the senior commander, the prosecution argued that he should have known and been able to prevent such a wholesale slaughter. He's ultimately charged with the deaths of 62,000 men, women, and children during that time period. And so he is in this trial, he is defended by American defense lawyers. And as they note, and I've read their memoirs and their oral histories, and they're all deceased now, but you know, they say here a month earlier he was their sworn enemy, and now they're doing everything they can to save his life.
And one of the senses I get out of this was that they felt like he was sort of railroaded in this trial, right?
They did, yes. And it's important to remember that this was not a an American civilian trial or even a courts martial. I mean, this was a hybrid. This was, as one newspaper called it, an allied legal laboratory. I mean, MacArthur's office wrote the regulations for which this trial would be handled. They allowed things like hearsay and even triple hearsay, which would not normally be allowed in an American court. And hearsay.
Triple hearsay being, I heard this from somebody who heard it from somebody.
Who heard it from somebody.
Right.
It's like that far removed. And the reason hearsay is not allowed in American courts is because, you know, you as a defendant, you're allowed to be able to cross-examine your accuser, and you can't cross-examine somebody who told somebody who told somebody. And so it's not allowed. It's not considered fair. But they allowed that in this trial, and the judges were guided by what they said, anything of probative value that illuminates what happened. And so it has very loose, I think Robert Trumbull from the New York Times even said, you know, the rules of the Yamashita trial are, there are no rules, you know, anything goes, if you will.
And MacArthur was sort of monitoring it, and it sounds like basically making sure he was take care of this guy, right?
Yeah, he was, you know, he wasn't in the Philippines at this point. He was in Japan where the occupation was beginning, but the defense was asking for more time in order to prepare because the prosecution had, since the battle ended all the way up until October of 1945, they'd had all these months to do all these interviews, track down these witnesses, get their statements. And, of course, the defense has all of about 3 weeks to prepare. And so they had asked, hey, we're going to need a continuance on this because we're going to need to re-interview people and prepare an actual defense. And MacArthur got wind of it, and he says, no, I'm alarmed that there's any possibility of a continuance. This trial needs to go ahead and take place and to really push this thing forward.
There wasn't much doubt about the outcome.
No. And I think, you know, you had the judges were five officers who were all subordinate of MacArthur. Who, you know, were there sitting on a raised platform listening to all the evidence. What is interesting about the trial, too, I'll add, is there were 286 witnesses that participated in this trial. It lasted over about 32 days. Ultimately filled a trial transcript of over 4,000 pages with another 1,700 pages of just exhibits. And it really was the litigation of a battle. I mean, if you imagine, like, imagine putting Fallujah on trial or, you know, Gettysburg on trial or any of these trials. That's what happened in this case.
Like an ethical sense, basically.
Kind of, but also just sort of like, this is what happened. I mean, here you had, these were victims of this battle who were then brought in to tell what happened to them during this battle. And they came from all walks of life. You had doctors, you had nurses, you had teachers, you had gravediggers. And so it really became sort of this airing of grievances and atrocities that had happened during the Battle of Manila. And so it really, the trial itself is a fascinating window into the battle, into the civilian experience during that battle. And as you noted earlier, you know, people in the audience would get up and yell, and one woman was caught outside with a bag of rocks that she was trying to sneak inside. I mean, so these, you know, these emotions were so raw because it happened right there in the city right after the battle. And so one of the Japanese prisoners of war at that time were still being, they were being used to help clean up the city afterwards. And one of the journalists in his diary wrote that the guards that were protecting them when they were out there didn't keep their guns trained on the prisoners of war, but they had to keep their guns trained on the civilians who might want to jump out there and attack them.
Sure.
So, I mean, the tensions and the hostilities were just so raw and inflamed at that point.
Yeah. And what happened to Yamashita?
He was found guilty.
Unsurprisingly.
Surprisingly. And his defense lawyers, you know, they appealed his case first to the Philippines Supreme Court, which basically said they didn't have standing. And then they appealed it all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And the court agreed to hear it. So several of his defense lawyers flew over, and actually they had oral arguments. The Supreme Court decided that the case, that Yamashita's case had been fair, and two dissenting votes, and the rest voted in favor, and so opened the door for him to be executed at that point.
And his noose was cut into pieces?
Yes, after he was hanged, he was, the rope that was used to hang him was cut up into 6-inch pieces, which were given out to Bataan Death March survivors.
In general, do you have an idea of sort of how the Japanese view this whole event?
You know, for the Japanese, there were 17,000 troops in the city. 16,665 were killed. So there were only a handful of survivors on the Japanese side. Those that did survive were often left on the battlefield because they had standing orders to kill the wounded. And they were just considered to be too far gone, if you will, head injuries, stomach injuries, things like that. And so we interrogated them all afterwards. But in general, the Japanese have really kind of, a number of years ago, there was an apology made for what had happened in Manila, and I believe one of the ambassadors came to one of the annual memorials that they host there in the old walled city every year. In fact, I'm going to be there this year for it, and in February I'm giving the talk that morning there. But in general, the Japanese don't really, you know, they don't dwell on this. There's not a lot of exploration of what happened here, And that's a sense of concern and alarm. I mean, the Filipinos are still, to give you a perfect example even, they were looking, earlier this year, they put up a statue outside the Bayview Hotel, which had been a site of many of the sexual assaults. And so there was a statue put up in Manila that had permission of the local city government. And then, you know, a few days later, the statue came down again. And the federal government actually had stepped in and said, hey, you know, there's a roadworks project this is going to be in the way of. But the scuttlebutt amongst folks in Manila is that, you know, there was a lot of pressure put by the Japanese government that they didn't want this monument put up there. And you know, Japan's a big investor in the Philippines these days. So these scars of the battle and these tensions, they play out today. It's almost 74 years later.
Well, you kind of answered this a little bit, but I wanted to say, how do people in the Philippines and in Manila, how are they interpreting that history now? What happened there? Because I know you mentioned a couple of times in the book that some people in Manila blame the Americans almost as much as
the Japanese. Absolutely, yeah. And I'll tell you, you know, it's important to remember, this is a story that, you know, it affected generations of families. I mean, you had some families that were totally wiped out. You had everyone from grandparents to grandchildren in one family killed. So the ripples of that go through lives all the way up until today. You do have a very active survivors organization in Manila called the Memorare Manila 1945 Foundation that hosts lectures and events and things like that, that have put up statues and plaques around the city and things like that. For so many years afterwards, however, because there was such close association with Douglas MacArthur and that there was a reluctance to want to blame the United States, because America fired 42,000 artillery rounds into the city during this battle. I mean, there's no doubt that lots and lots
once
of civilians.
Once they were in, they were all in.
Yeah, and Bob Baitler, who was the commander of the 37th Infantry, said, "Yeah, my job was to protect American lives, not buildings." And so, the American artillery did a number on it, and a lot of civilians died as a result of that. But for years, there was a reluctance to criticize the Americans because of the close association between America and the Philippines, and of course Douglas MacArthur. That's changing now that we're moving out, you know, 3/4 of a century, and it's easier for people to evaluate it sort of unemotionally of what's going on. And there's no doubt that Americans played a huge role in the destruction of a lot of the buildings and the loss of a lot of lives. I mean, you just can't fire that much artillery into a city and not kill people, and particularly because the Japanese were holing up in places where the civilians were, you know, in hospitals and places like that, which just makes it in that much harder to get them out. So you are seeing that recognition that the United States played a role in the destruction of Manila as well as the Japanese.
Are there lessons that the military of, like the U.S. military today, takes from this? Are there things that they look at and say, we did this really well, we didn't do this well.
There is. And I actually was up at the in Carlisle Barracks last year at the and was having dinner with some of the faculty members one night. And they said that they've, because of what's been going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, where you're seeing these sort of urban battles and things like that, they've seen a rise in interest of people who are spending their time there studying the Battle of Manila. And because there's so many parallels from the Battle of Manila to what our troops have fought in the Middle East. I mean, because the Japanese were low on resources, so they literally took guns off of ships that had been blown up in the harbor and then reconfigured them for pillboxes. You know, they built Molotov cocktails.
Explain what a pillbox is.
Yeah, a pillbox is essentially a covered bunker that you would mount a machine gun in and put it like at an intersection essentially to be able to shoot anybody that's going to be advancing on you. And so what the Japanese did is they spent about a month and they fortified Manila. They went into buildings and they cut machine gun slits in walls. They built staggered inside passageways inside these big, and these are heavy concrete buildings that they knew could withstand artillery. You know, they built these staggered partitions inside passageways. And
so you couldn't like walk straight through them.
You couldn't walk straight through them. You had to sort of weave between them. And so the same type of things you see, for instance, if you're overseas and you're trying to drive up to an American base and you've got to go between all the partitions. They booby-trapped dead bodies. They booby-trapped dead animals. They booby-trapped chapels and things like that. So a lot of that creativity, that improvised explosive devices, things like that became sort of that you see so common in Iraq, happened during the Battle of Manila. And so there were tremendous lessons to be learned. And the troops that were coming in to fight in the Battle of Manila, they'd been fighting on beaches and in jungles, places like New Guinea. So for them, it was this whole new education that they were having to learn. Each block was a new education that they secured through the battle. For instance, I mean, one of the weapons they realized, I read in one of the reports, was so dangerous is that the Japanese were using sawed-off shotguns with bayonets, I mean, for close-quarters combat. Well, the Americans figured out, hey, you know, the flamethrower is a really great weapon to use in these situations. But if you're in a tight room, it can suck up all the oxygen, and it can also ricochet. And so, I mean, these troops were having to learn how to fight in this new environment. And, yeah, absolutely, you see that. You see it reflected in stuff we're dealing with today.
So beyond the military lessons that people might take from it, what do you think is, or maybe sort of the moral lessons of this particular battle? Is there anything that you draw from it as you were researching it and writing about it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's such a, it's a wasted battle. There was no strategic value to Manila. I mean, it was a pointless place to square off. And it came at such an incredibly high price, and that price was paid by civilians. I mean, the Japanese lost just shy of 17,000. The Americans, we had about 1,000 killed and 5,500 wounded, but it was the civilians. I mean, almost 100,000 civilians died, either through artillery or through being burned to death or bayoneted. It's one of those battles that even though you won the battle, everybody really lost. And I mean, in the city, history, Manila was this ancient city, you know. You had centuries-old cathedrals that lay in ruins. I mean, the challenge afterwards was, how do you value that? I mean, how do you value a church that was built by the Jesuits, you know, in the late 1500s, early 1600s, and it's now been totally destroyed? I mean, all the cultural losses, the historical losses, the economic losses, I mean, Manila was just wrecked. And you can still see the scars of it on the city even today.
So if you go over there, you see, like, Are there like buildings that were destroyed? They kind of left.
Yeah, there were. I mean, the old walled city of Intramuros, which was sort of where some of the worst fighting took place. It was fallow all the way through the 1970s. I mean, it was filled with squatters. They've realized now that it's a great tourist attraction because it's a walled city that dates back to the 1500s, and so now you go there and there are carriage rides like in Charleston, and there's a Starbucks. But for years, it sat empty. Now, what essentially happened is afterwards, it was so much damage that rather than rebuild Manila right away, the planners essentially moved just south of it and built a brand new city called Makati, which is where all the glass and steel high rises are, and the banks and the department stores, and so Manila was kind of left as a sort of decadent place. Now, the German Club, to give you another example, which was the scene of one of the worst atrocities where about 500 people were burned to death in a social hall, it's never been redeveloped. It's just empty, hallowed ground in Manila today. So, and you go, for instance, into La Salle Chapel there at the where a number of families were killed as well, and the tile floors are the same tile floors that they were 74 years ago. So, I mean, the ghosts of this battle still haunt this city.
This is also a story about the folly of some leaders or powerful people who cause a lot of suffering to prove a point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, MacArthur in some ways wanted to come back and prove that he was really going to save Manila and the Philippines. At least the Japanese emperor, people higher than Yamashita maybe, wanted to make one last stand and prove that they were worthy. And it sort of became this big shoving match that, that ended up causing a lot of loss and suffering. I guess I see a few parallels to current times where people are tend to do a lot of posturing that in the end, you kind of have to play the cards if you're doing that. And that's, it feels like to me part of what happened in this case.
You're right. And I'll tell you, you know, and MacArthur misread the situation going in. I mean, he coming in was convinced that the Japanese would do exactly what he did and abandon the city. He had his headquarters staff preparing his liberation parade down to picking the jeep assignments of his senior officers, directing the parade route so it went back in front of his home there at the Manila Hotel. Meanwhile, his senior commanders and intelligence officers are saying, you know, hey, we're getting signs that the Japanese are fortifying the city and that this is actually going to be more of a fight than we anticipate. And MacArthur blew them off and said, you know, nonsense. They're going to do what I say they do, basically putting his gut instinct over the intelligence coming out of the city. And he was wrong.
Have you come to any like cosmic conclusions or thoughts about necessity of war or the strategy or tactics or anything you feel like that you understand now in a more profound way than you did when all this started?
That war is something that ever since humans, you know, have been around, there's been war. And I don't see that changing. And that's the tragedy of it, is that it's, you would think that so many of these things would create these lessons and whatnot. And yet, you know, we've gone on since World War II to be involved in Vietnam, Korea, Iraq, Afghanistan. And I think some of the important things that were set up, I mean, the attacks on the UN, and don't get me wrong, I mean, the UN, like any big administration, is going to have its faults. But I mean, the UN was essentially designed as a way to prevent these types of conflicts, to create this forum in which nations could get together and hash things out through diplomacy. Because, you know, war it should be your last resort. And yet here we're pulling out of UN agencies and shunning it and things like that instead of taking an active role if we have problems with it and trying to correct that. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, I mean, it's there to prevent these types of conflicts. But that's the sad thing, is that wars, you know, they've always been fought and they probably always will be.
You live in Charleston, mm-hmm. which obviously has this deep military history, mm-hmm. Citadel's there. Mm-hmm.
All this do a lot of research there.
Yeah, do a lot. So the Citadel has a lot of archives on...
They have a really great military library. So when I'm looking for, you know, some general's battlefield memoir, things like that, chances are I can go to the Citadel and find it.
Do you feel like that living in Charleston sort of informs what you do at all, since that place is so kind of military-oriented in some way?
Yeah, I mean, you can't live in Charleston and not just be affected by the history of it all. I mean, you know, my children, for instance, they go out on field trips to Fort Sumter, which is, you know, where the Civil War started. Just about a year and a half, 2 years ago, I was on a run one morning through my neighborhood, and I live in Mount Pleasant, and, you know, I'm going up this little street by the waterfront there, and, you know, all these police and rescue vehicles are out there, and I'm like, oh my gosh, what's happened? So I stopped, asked one of my neighbors, he's like, the bomb squad's up there. I'm like, why's the bomb squad here in Mount Pleasant? He says, you know, they're redoing a house up there, and they found an old unexploded shell from the Civil War.
Wow.
And, you know, that happens a couple times a year in Charleston. Some renovation project uncovers some, you know, ordnance that's been around for, you know, century or more. And so you're constantly reminded by that. I mean, I have a cemetery just a few blocks from my house in my neighborhood that has, you know, dead from the War of 1812. So you can't not live in Charleston and not have that appreciation for it all.
I want to circle back to one last thing. We mm-hmm. kind of started this out by talking about your dad mm-hmm. and his experience and how this kind of led you on this path in your mm-hmm. career. Having written a book that's kind of about his experience, and then these other books that are about the experiences of the war, have those led you to see your dad in a different light?
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you, it's so funny, you know, as a former newspaper reporter, and you know this too, you know, you spend your life interviewing people and telling other people's stories. And for me, doing a book on dad, that was this one, it was such a personal experience to sort of turn that skill set onto someone you know and love and to start examining your dad's life. And I did it when I was about 30. And so it's a time in my life when you're normally growing away from your parents and you're sort of striking out on your own. Here I was really circling back and starting to examine this period of my father's life. And I'll tell you, my father passed away a year ago yesterday. after a battle with Alzheimer's. And I will tell you, one of the things I am most grateful for is that opportunity I had to spend those 3 years researching and working with Dad, because it gave me a relationship with Dad beyond, you know, your childhood relationship, but an adult-to-adult relationship that I think a lot of sons don't always get. And I'm so grateful for that. I mean, my dad actually, he went to Israel with me when I was doing my research. And, you know, and so we had this bonding experience over there. He met one of the pilots who led the attack on his ship. And, you know, that pilot apologized to Dad. And so, I mean, through my research into this story, it helped bring about a sense of closure for my dad that I'm so grateful for.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
James Scott, thank you very much, man.
Thank you, Tommy. It's great to be with you.
What does war do to us? It seems to me that's the message of James Scott's book. War made Douglas MacArthur determined to fulfill his promise no matter the cost. It made the Japanese military fight a losing battle in a futile attempt to save face. It turned ordinary citizens into soldiers who did unspeakable things. And it led to the death and suffering 100,000 civilians who were simply in the wrong city at the wrong time when superpowers decided to fight. Too many wars have been fought for similar flimsy reasons by leaders long on ego and short on empathy. They're noble reasons to fight and times when it's the only way. But there are also times when thousands of lives are lost for no good reason. And then the only thing to do is what James Scott did. Tell the story and hope people listen. We don't seem to be much for listening in our country these days. That makes for the kind of climate where we repeat history's mistakes. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Delacanal. Our web managers are Jessa O'Connor and Zuri Berry. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch, and our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and every episode of Southbound on the NPR One app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.